It's an honor to be here, and some of you may know this. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. That Insight Santa Cruz was actually housed here at the Zen Center for many years on Tuesdays at noon, and then eventually we moved to another church, and then later got our own space at 1010 Fair Avenue in the West Side, and then gradually we're now in downtown, and I'm going to be in the Galleria. We're in a temporary space until the place that we're going to be moving into is renovated. And we just found out we got the building permit approved yesterday. Yay. And I was very touched seeing picture of Catherine Thanis. I was a very close friend of hers. I loved her very, very much, and I always have a deep kinship with Zen. And actually, one of my very first Zen teachers was Sensei Kobenchino many, many years ago. And actually, before that was in a different Zen tradition, Bishop Nipo Siaku, who was very much into the Majjhimika Karika of Nagarjuna, and I studied very intensively with him for some time, and so I feel that I feel very connected to the Zen tradition, and very wonderful to be in this very beautiful Zendo, that as I sat here, like, there's been a lot of sitting in this space for many, many years, and it feels really good to me. And, I've taught daylongs here. I remember one of the last daylongs I taught here was on the mindfulness of death, and we walked down to Harvey West, to the cemetery there, and spent a day in the cemetery and then came back here as part of our day of practice. So so anyways, I'm very happy to be here. And I'm told that tomorrow's the beginning of a retreat and in celebration in honor of the Buddha's enlightenment. Is that's right? Yeah. It's interesting in our Buddhist traditions, and the Theravadin, it's the full moon of May, and it's called the thrice blessed day, of the day of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and parinirvana. And so so it's wonderful that also here in this December, this is also honored. And, you know, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to talk about tonight. So I brought a few pieces of paper, and then also was just found out about this is the eve of the Buddha's enlightenment. So I knew right away to let's speak about the Buddha and the Buddha's enlightenment. And so that's what I'd like to speak about. And you know, I really love the story of the Buddha. It's actually a very personal story to me, and it reflects some of my own journey in life. And, you know, and so it's said, of course, that he was born into a noble family and destined to become a great king. And in his 29th year, he encountered these messengers that are known as the heavenly messengers. And so, actually, I'll just say, so I'm going to give you the Theravadin version. That's what I know. A little bit. And so he encountered these messengers that are known as the heavenly messengers. There's actually four of them. And living a very sheltered life, he stepped outside of the palace gates when he was 29 years old with this charioteersman named Chana, kind of like an Uber driver. And he went out of this palace, and he came across, and as if his eyes opened for the very first time, where he saw a very old person. And he'd never seen an old person like this before, or somehow lived in such a sheltered type of way he just awoke that this was an aging person and asked Chana, who is this? And he goes, well, if you live long enough, your hair will turn gray, what hair is left, and that you'll get old, that there's no escape from aging. And on another outing, he came across a very ill person, very, very sick, deathly sick, and asked Chana, who is this? And goes, this is a person that's ill, and you know, everyone sooner or later will get ill. No one can escape from illness. And the third time he went out, not so long after that, he came across a corpse, a dead body, and saw this body was lifeless, not breathing, discolored, not moving. And asked Chana, who is this? And Chana said, this is a person who has died. And Siddhartha began to realize, like, this too will happen. That, and Chana said, yes, no one will escape from death. This left him in quite a turmoil and began to realize, what is the use of becoming a king if nothing is going to last? But was in a quandary, did not know what to do, but was very, very upset. And on his fourth time out, he met a monk, a wandering ascetic. And he just saw in the way that the monk or the nun walked very deliberately, very mindfully, very attentively, that this person radiated something very different than any other person he'd ever met before. And when inquiring about who is this person, Chana said, this is a person that's dedicating their life to awakening, to the truth. He had never been exposed or ever understood that this was even a possibility. And he realized then and there that this is what he must do. He had it in Pali, which is a canonical language of early Buddhism. There's a particular word or phrase that can pack quite a lot of meaning. And so what happened to the Buddha, or Siddhartha Gautama, not yet the Buddha, was that he had this what's called a samvega consciousness. And a samvega means that when you have the realization that death can come at any moment, it catapults you into a sense of spiritual urgency to understand what is this life. So that's quite a paragraph for one word, samvega, this urgency to awaken when you realize death can come at any moment. And so he realized that he needed to leave the palace. Even though his wife was pregnant and about to give birth, and his father begged him, he'd heard that he was going to be leaving, and said, son, I can give you everything. And so Siddhartha said, all right, Dad, if you can promise me three things, I'll stay. And he was very happy to hear that because he was very wealthy. He was a king. And he said, surely I can grant him whatever he wants. And so Siddhartha said, you know, grant me to spare me from aging, illness, and death. And the king could not do that. So on the eve of that night, he let go of his princely garments, gave them away, and put on some rag robes, and shaved his head, and left into the forest, left the kingdom. It is also said, of course, that his wife was about to give birth, and he knew, of course, that his wife and his soon-to-be child would be well taken care of in the kingdom. And I always like to say, just to jump ahead a little bit, that after the Buddha's awakening, he came back to his wife and to his son and gave them the royal inheritance, and they all got enlightened and lived happily ever after as well. But there is a beautiful part of that story, because some people might think, like, he left, but he did come back and gave them the gift of the Dharma to help them to awaken. And so it's said that he traveled from teacher to teacher. He was an excellent student. He mastered the different meditative practices that were common of the day, and particularly in that type of day of practice, it was mostly concentration meditation, developing absorption, one-pointedness of mind, developing in Pali different types of jhanas, absorptions, unification, one-pointedness, tranquility, serenity, oneness. But he discovered as he mastered these meditations that it still wasn't giving him the answer. And often these master teachers say, you've learned everything that I've learned, come and sit next to me and you can teach with me. But still this deep understanding about life had not been experienced. Now Doughty could calm his mind down to profound levels of oneness and serenity, tranquility, absorption, unification, but that understanding of the causes of suffering and pain was not there. And so he had heard that perhaps the path is through the punishment of the body, self-mortification. And so he, pardon me, began these practices of self-mortification. And it said that he reduced his food intake to 1 grain of rice a day until he came upon collapse, exhaustion. It said that when he put his hands on his belly, he could almost feel his tailbone. He was really an extreme mortification, and he began to realize the futility, that he still had not understood what is this life. And so he left these practices of self-mortification and took food again, nourished the body. And he eventually came across a very beautiful tree and decided to stay and sit underneath this tree. And he kind of took a resolve deep inside him, realizing that there's no other teacher to go see, no other practice to do, and I'm just going to stay here. This kind of this commitment, I'll stay here till my skin rolls off my bones. It's just this commitment that I need to stay here. There's no other place to go. No other teaching. I need to see with my own direct experience. So what time it is. Okay, doing good. And it said that as he began his sit and practice, he recalled another time, a number of years ago, when he was a young boy and he was sitting underneath another tree, a very beautiful tree, and it was on a beautiful day. And he recalled during that time that it was one of those days where, you know, sometimes we get these days in Santa Cruz, just these perfect, beautiful days, and just remembering the beauty of that day, and then also recalled, because it was such a contrast of that beauty of that moment sitting underneath that tree many years ago, that in a field right nearby there was some farmers and some ox and plows, and they were just getting ready to dig into the soil to turn it over to begin to plant for the food. And perhaps because his sensitivity was so heightened, when the plow blades came into the earth, he almost sensed or could feel the cries of the worms in pain and agony. And it said it was one of these very powerful moments of experiencing like this joy and beauty, the preciousness of this world, and then the profound sorrow, the pain, the fragility. And it said that he began then to become aware of his breath. But something happened underneath the tree there that had never happened before. To me, this is like a really important moment. And it makes sense to me, is that up to that time, the practices were absorption and unification and oneness. And he had that concentrated awareness, but what he did was, rather than moving into full, complete absorption, he began to become aware and directly experience the changing nature in Pali Anicca, the impermanent nature of the breath in and the breath out. This was a huge shift from unification and absorption to experiencing the nature of change. And this led to potentially some very profound insights, realizations. We call them the Four Noble Truths, that he awakened underneath the tree of awakening, or the Bodhi tree. In the First Noble Truth, we understand it's this understanding of suffering or dissatisfactoriness. And he just really began to just acknowledge that in this existence, as wonderful as it is, there also is the truth of suffering, that in birthing this suffering, and aging, and illness, and death is suffering, being around those or situations that are uncomfortable is suffering. So just this sense of this knowledge and understanding that penetrated into his depths of this understanding of this dissatisfactoriness. We actually have a number of words for that in our English language. Anguish, anxiety, affliction, dissatisfaction, discomfort, discontentment, frustration, misery, sorrow, stress, suffering, uneasiness, the list goes on. And the Buddha discovered that at the root of suffering, this is beginning to understand its causes, was unawareness, was ignorance, was not seeing clearly into things. And my teacher, my lineage comes from the Burmese forest tradition of Thongpu Lucero, was a Burmese monk. He died in 1986. This is what he has to say about ignorance. He says, midnight is dark, the new moon is dark, the thickness of the forest is dark, but darkest of all is ignorance. Darkest of all is ignorance. This is why there's so much emphasis in these teachings on awareness, on mindfulness, because if you are aware, you can begin to break the cycle. This is what he used to say. There's a teaching, I think, that in this tradition you're familiar with, the Paticca Samuppada, dependent origination. Yeah? And so Seto had a very beautiful, very pithy explanation. He goes, with dependent origination, these 12 dependent links that cause the cycles of suffering. He says, if you know, you can break the cycle. If you don't know, you will go around and around and around. And so this emphasis of awareness, this is how important mindfulness is. Awareness dispels ignorance. And because of this ignorance or unawareness, it gives rise to craving. It gives rise to beliefs that perhaps I can find happiness outside of myself. It's a great misconception. When we speak about desires, it is very common and natural for us as human beings to have our desires. So I don't want to necessarily say that desires are morally wrong, but that they're simply causes of suffering. And why? It's because you're wanting what you can't have. And so that very nature of wanting what you can't have spins the cycle of discontentment, dis-ease. And particularly if it's matched with unawareness and beliefs begin to arise that we can find our happiness somewhere else. Says in the Dharma that there's no fire hotter than greed and no ice colder than hatred and no fog thicker than ignorance. And so due to these types of misconceptions, we perhaps develop beliefs about our happiness. So the Buddha discovered in the second foundation of the second noble truth, or great realization, which is I really want to emphasize tonight, because to me this is a very important teaching, because it's beginning to understand the nature of suffering. And if we can understand this, potentially we can begin to lessen it. And I think it is incredibly brilliant of the Buddha's discoveries of the causes of suffering. And this, of course, leads to the path of its lessening and ending. And there's a very beautiful translation of the causes of suffering by a Buddhist monk, Achen Amaro, who's an Englishman in the Thai tradition. And so I'd like to read it to you. So this is regarding the second noble truth that the Buddha discovered underneath the Bodhi tree. Because this is the noble truth of the cause of suffering, and it is craving. It is craving that is compelling and intoxicating, which causes us to be born into things again and again. Anybody ever experienced that? I love it. Compelling and intoxicating, that causes us to be born into things again and again. Ever seeking delight now here and now there. Namely, it is the craving for sensual delight, the craving to be something, and the craving to feel nothing. This is a very powerful discovery about the nature of suffering through unawareness that gives rise to these cravings and these beliefs that somehow happiness can be found through sensual delights or to be someone or to feel nothing. Very brilliant. So I'd like to unpack these a little bit. And so this craving for sensual delight, it's like eros, it's the libido, it's this drive to feel good. And manifests itself in life a lot, the drive to for food, for sex, shopping. Amazon, I don't work for Amazon, but Amazon, like one click, you buy it, you own it, it gives a little rush of adrenaline. It's like there's a certain thrill in buying. Television shows, etc. There's so many things. This urge to feel good. I remember one time eating my favorite vegan ice cream many years ago, and I was eating it, and I was in the land of satiation. It was just wonderful. I was at one with the ice cream. It was just great. I was having a great time. I was eating it. And then all of a sudden I look, there's one spoonful left. And I got sad. I didn't know what I was going to do. I'll go get another bowl. But I caught myself. I saw so clearly. Here's where I was caught. But what is this? Like, I wanted to feel good. But it was... it's like trying to hold water in your hands. It's seeping out, looking for this in outside of me. It's very insidious, this belief that these sensual delights, I'm not against them, but let us understand, they won't give us the permanent happiness, but we can get so caught in them through all the things that we do. The last words of Crowfoot, a Blackfoot chief, says, "What is life?" These are the last words of Crowfoot. He goes, "What is life? It's like the flash of a firefly in the night. It is like the breath of a buffalo in the winter time. It is like a little shadow which runs across the grass and loses itself into the sunset. So fleeting. But it's its drive to want to feel good, So Kabir, he says, friend, please tell me what I can do about this world that I hold on to and I keep on spinning out. I gave up my sewn clothes and I wore a robe. But then one day, I noticed that the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap. But I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. Well, I pulled back my sexual longings, but now I discover I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. This poem goes on for a long, long, long time. So perhaps I could say there's a theme song. Joko and I were discussing our love of music earlier. So the theme song, I think, for the craving for sensual delight is from the Rolling Stones, I just can't get no satisfaction. No matter how much I try and I try and I try, I just can't get no satisfaction. This craving for sensual delight, very insidious. And even more insidious is the craving to be someone. Narcissism, super ego. I'm sitting in the teacher's seat. I must be a really cool guy. I hope actually that after this talk, you'll say, this is the best Dharma talk you ever heard. But you know what? It will not be enough because I'll forget and I'll get insecure again and I'm going to have to ask you again to tell me because I am dependent upon you so that I know my self-worth as a human being. This is where we can get so caught in this craving to be someone, born out of the insecurity that I am not enough. There's all these stories, all these narratives of my own deficiency and inadequacy, and so I need you for my wholeness. This is a very painful aspect of suffering, this craving to be someone. And it's really funny, because when you think about it, everyone else is taken. The only one that is not taken is oneself, if you will. And yet how much do we leave ourselves in search for the sense of wholeness, the sense of Buddha nature that perhaps is within us? I also want to say that developmentally, it's so important that we do develop this sense of a healthy self, whatever that means. John Kabat-Zinn and his wife Myla, they wrote a very beautiful book called Everyday Blessings, The Art of Mindful Parenting, and they speak about three very important aspects of developing, supporting, raising your child. And the three are acceptance and empathy, which is pretty easy to understand. And the third one is called sovereignty, honoring the sovereignty of your child. And first, I wasn't quite sure what they meant till they began to explain more that, you know, most of us, when we come out of our womb, particularly young infants, they are just so full of themselves. You know, they could be up here giving this Dharma talk to you and completely pooping in their pants, and they don't really care what you think. Or they may laugh, they may cry, they may do whatever they do. Like, they're just so full of themselves. And then, of course, we get raised and we learn that it's not so good to be doing that in front of a group of people. You should go there. And inevitably, as time goes on, we lose that sense of sovereignty. We get shamed. We're made to feel small, made to feel inadequate. And so it's very important on one level that we are fostered and developed in a way that we can learn to love and to care for ourselves. But when we keep on getting shamed, and perhaps there's different stories that are told to us, you're not going to amount to anything. You're not pretty. You're not smart. I remember my parents saying, it's a good thing you got your brother because you're not going to make much money. Well, turned out they called me right because I'm a teach Dharma. Make enough. It's okay. But the stories are sometimes that we get told that we begin to believe in. I remember a friend of mine once, they were in a different, difficult family situation, and his mother had committed suicide. And there was the father with four boys. And my friend was very tall and very clumsy. And he would knock into things and things would get knocked over. So his father began to call him a nickname. Terrible name. You all have heard of King Midas. Everything you touch turns to gold. That children's story. But he was called the opposite. King Minus. Everything you touch breaks. It's a really terrible story. And, you know, there's kind of a happier ending where he realized that this type of stories that he told himself that fed his sense of deficiency, inadequacy, shame, unworthiness, were these were narratives and stories that weren't fully who he was. That these were limited definitions. If we're lucky enough on the path that we begin to discover that these stories that we've told ourselves are stories, this is huge. For our practice, to begin to become more free of the stories that have enslaved us. To me, this is the most liberating teaching of the Dharma, is to begin to become aware of the stories that we've told ourselves, these self-definitions, and see that perhaps they're limited, that there's more than just what's here. This is what I believe the Buddha really discovered. Breaking through these conditions and stories and narratives in experiencing nibbana, freedom, the end of suffering. But this craving to be someone is very insidious in the sense that if we don't get that sense of nourishment really on, we begin to look for it elsewhere. So perhaps there's a country western song that we can speak that describes this, and it's called I'm Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places. The last craving, to feel nothing, is the thanatos, annihilation, the death instinct, rooted in the belief that if I can just kind of turn off, I can get away from my pain. This is like numbing. Drugs, alcohol, we get lost in the internet, television, radio, puzzles, crosswords. There's thousands of ways that we can relieve ourselves so we don't have to feel. Some years ago, there was a time where there was a possibility that my son had lymphoma, a type of cancer. Turned out that he didn't have it. He had mono. Which is very, not that I wish anyone to have mono, but mono was better than lymphoma. But during that time, there was about a week or two period of time that we didn't know, and I was very upset. I was actually teaching a retreat for a few days during that time as well, here locally, the Land of Medicine Buddha. And I was actually preparing a talk on these causes of suffering, and I never quite related to the craving to feel nothing. But while I was at that retreat, all I remember is very specifically, I'd get up and I'd go teach and practice, and then as soon as I was done, the only thing I wanted, I just headed right to my bed and I wanted to go to sleep. And then whenever I woke up, I was okay for a split second, and then it all came back. What's going to happen with my son? And then it's like, oh, this is what the Buddha was talking about. I had a big time. I didn't want to feel it. It was so incredibly painful to be with that possibility. I just wanted to sleep. I wanted to go numb. I didn't want to feel. And then I began to explore. I never really related much to that cause of suffering. And then I began to see it in my life in so many different places where I turn off from the present moment because I don't want to be there, numbing myself, being away from things. And so it's like, oh, this is what the Buddha's talking about, this craving to feel nothing, to turn away. It's hard to be with suffering. I mean, you want to acknowledge that. So perhaps we can say the theme song here for this is from Simon and Garfunkel. I am a rock, I am an island. And a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries. A sense of turning off from the moment. Turning off to what's here. Let's see what time it is. We're getting close. So these profound teachings of the causes of suffering, the craving for sensual delight, the craving to be something, to be someone, and the craving to feel nothing. This is what the Buddha discovered underneath the tree. So amazing. 2600 or so years later, we're still talking about what he had discovered in bringing these practices and principles into our lives. Such an incredible blessing. I mean, I just can't believe. I feel so grateful to be exposed to these teachings that I don't know what I would be doing in my life without these teachings. So winding back to those four heavenly messengers that I began, I believe that I know that all of you here have met these messengers. I don't think we could be sitting here if we haven't been touched by illness, aging, death. And somewhere along the line, we met someone that was a monk or a monastic or a meditator, or maybe read about it in a book about this, like something like brought you into Dharma. So we have all met these messengers. And I think on the eve of the Buddha's awakening, I want to invite you to maybe tonight and tomorrow, you can reflect upon who's been your messengers that have brought you onto the path. I'll tell you my fourth heavenly messenger. His name was Bill Jackson. And so I'll just say to come back a little bit, I was introduced to the first three heavenly messengers very early on. When I was 4 years old, I had my first realization that I was going to die and that it could happen to any moment, it could happen to anyone. I remember telling my mother and father this, and I was driving in the back seat of their car in Brighton, Massachusetts, driving down Quarry Hill Road. And I told them what I had just understood. I don't know why I thought of this, but I just all of a sudden understood it's all not going to last. And my mother and father said, "Don't worry, Bobby. It's not going to. It won't happen for a long, 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 long time." And I knew they were saying it very lovingly and very nicely, but I also knew they weren't telling me the truth, because what I knew was death could come at any moment. And unfortunately, by the time I was 9, I lost my younger brother, Buddy, who I shared a room with. He died of an illness. And my best friend, who lived across the street, who I played with every day, went into a diabetic coma and died one night. And my grandfather, who lived downstairs. These were my heavenly messengers growing up that left me very confused and dazed. Growing up in the 60s, the Beatles grew their hair long and the times were changing. I really was very lost and very confused growing up, and eventually barely graduating high school, and friends went off to college, is either that or getting drafted into Vietnam. I fortunately had a very high draft number. But I was very lost, didn't know what to do, and I got into downhill skiing and had to do an extra year of high school, and luckily I got accepted to a very small undergraduate school in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, where I majored in skiing for the first 2 years, in getting drunk and smoking marijuana and trying to have girlfriends. I was pretty good with skiing and getting drunk and getting high. Girlfriend department, not so well. So actually, at the end of my second year, I was given my notice that I had just flunked out, and was to be readmitted back on warning. And my mother begged me, "Isn't there something, Bobby, that you could take?" So I looked at the course catalog, I didn't want any more reading and writing and arithmetic and history and science. And I saw something that caught my eye. It said something like the wisdom of the East. I didn't know anything about that. And of course, I didn't see below it the colon, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and Zen. But there's something about the East that caught my eye. And I know this sounds funny, but it's really the truth. Growing up outside of Boston, my family loved Chinese food, and I, from a little boy, would be going to Chinese restaurants, and I absolutely loved Chinese food. And I would, like, not only the food, but going into the restaurants with the Buddhas and the dragons and the smells. And this was different than Howard Johnson's, which is like kind of like Dennis. It just was like something really allured me to the East since I was so young. There's something about it. And so that's what brought me to the class. And I went into the class, and I couldn't believe what I saw on my very first day. This professor was sitting on top of his desk in a full lotus position. I never had a professor like this ever before in my entire life. And this person was so embodied. I had never met a person that just... I could sense this guy knew something. I don't know what it was that he knew, but he knew something. And so I began to take this class, and he told us to start with the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, which I fell in love with the Tao. And then came across epigram number 47, which is, goes paraphrased something like, there's no need to look outside your window, for everything you need to know is inside you. And that kind of haunted me. And I read it again and again. There's no need to go outside. Everything you need to know is inside you. And that was when I really began to practice this realization. I never thought in my entire life this idea of actually beginning to look inside you. It just never occurred to me. I never thought about that. And this teaching is, begin to look in here if you want to know something. So Bill Jackson, he was the professor. He was my heavenly messenger that really brought me into the practice. And I actually connected with him on Facebook many years later. He retired from teaching at a World Religions somewhere in Indiana University. And I was able to tell him and to thank him. He probably didn't even know what type of impact he had on my life. So whether one is alive or even dead, maybe it's somehow the way that Mother Teresa lived or the way Bodhidharma lived, that somehow you heard and like that inspired you that there's another way. Mm-hmm. So on this evening, I want you definitely to reflect upon these messengers that touched you, that brought you into the path of Dharma, into the path of awakening and dedicating your life for all beings to help serve ourselves and others. So I think my time is here, and we will just sit for another minute and we'll end. So I'll end with a beautiful three-line verse from a Spanish poet, Antonio Machado, that just came to me. He says, some say it's good to dream, and others say it's better to live. But best of all, my friend, is to awaken. Best of all, my friend, is to awaken. Thank you.